a lot of history here. I lived in Eugene area for a decade, and I ended up going to classes at LCC. I was a Saturday marketeer, and that was our bread and butter. And I had a toddler at home, and I was really just looking for some time out of the house and stimulation for my brain other than creative like stuff. So I started going to LCC, and I was dabbling in classes, a little Spanish, a little yoga, a little short story writing. You know, I always like to write. And one day, you know, going to school on the bus, the torch was on the seat next to me. I picked it up and I was reading it, and there was an ad that they were looking for reporters. And I was like, oh, that sounds pretty cool. I always like to write. I've been on school papers before. So I went to their next meeting and I walked away with my first assignment. Within a few months, I was a news editor. By the next year, I was editor-in-chief of The Torch. We had a banner year. My advisor at The Torch at the time, Pete Peterson, kept nudging me to, why don't you get a transfer degree? How many credits do you have? And I added it up and realized, gee, I'm not that far off if I really like focus. Got my 2-year degree. Pete Peterson helped me land a scholarship, a diversity scholarship at U of O, and he pushed me to apply at the journalism school. I graduated there in 2003.
Now you're back, having given a keynote speech at the University of Oregon. And are you feeling reconnected with the Eugene area? What's familiar and what's changed?
I feel very, very much. Well, for one, I lived here a decade before ever going to school. I didn't move here to go to school. So my daughter lives here, my ex-husband lives here, and many, many, many friends that I've known since I was probably 18 years old live here. So it's like friends that are as tight as family.
You grew up on the Yakima Reservation in Washington. Were there experiences or lessons learned there that you've carried with you throughout your life?
Very, very much so. What I learned there was how to persevere. Despite the odds and against the odds, I could make a different life for myself than the rest of my family had. I'm the first in my family to have gotten a college degree. I don't know if I learned like what to do. I learned what not to do being raised on the reservation.
What were some things not to do?
Become a binge alcoholic. Get into abusive relationships. Be a criminal. End up in jail.
Or did you get the idea that it was time to explore new opportunities off the reservation?
The summer I turned 13, my mom and brother and I went to my grandfather's funeral in Southern California, which is where I was born. And while I was there, I was like, Mom, you know you want to move here and have for a long time. And if you still want to, I'd be open to it. So we went home, we had a big yard sale, sold off a bunch of stuff, rented a great big U-Haul, and Mom drove it from the reservation down to Southern Cal.
What's your cultural background, by the way? You're part Indian?
Yes. My father's family is Mexican-American, and my mother's family on her mom's side is Yakima. Well, actually, we're Cowlitz, but the 1855 Allotment Act that sent people to reservations is how we ended up on the Yakima Reservation. And the Yakima Reservation is actually like 13 different bands and tribes that make up Yakima.
Tanya, you were part of the Sun Sentinel's coverage of the Parkland school shooting in 2018. What was the most challenging part of that story for you?
For me personally, I mean, I wasn't the one who was doing all the document fights and stuff, you know, and getting threatened with contempt and being jailed by judges and so forth. I had to go, like, every day I just go there after school and park in the student parking lot and just kind of try to talk to kids and gather, widen our sore space. And teenagers are really hard to talk to. It's hard to make them relax.
And especially talking about an incident like that.
Yeah. So that was hard for me, approaching the teens, just cold approaching. If I, like, called them or, you know, we'd arranged an appointment or something, that's fine. Just the cold, you know, out of the blue approaching, that was tricky with kids.
What was your technique or best practice as far as getting them to open up to you?
not sure what my formula was. One thing I think is the March for Our Lives kids were getting so much attention and focus that I did find the others were willing and rather delighted to have an opportunity to talk to feel like their voices mattered, not just these rock stars.
It's been commented on that besides the victims, their friends and families, responders, which includes journalists, can often feel after effects of traumatic events. Have you contended at times with PTSD or other conditions that follow incidents like shootings and disasters?
I actually am diagnosed with PTSD, but that's because of my childhood. I have thought it's really interesting and it'd be fascinating, like a long-term look, because I'm thinking of the community of Parkland, and I think that entire community is going to be dealing with PTSD for a long time. The students, the teachers, the entire school, the faculty, the families. I just wonder how that's going to really affect everybody. All those kids, like, you know, they were in a devastating crisis situation, scared for their lives. And then they had to go back to that same school.
Walk
by that building.
I was reading the summary and the timeline in the Sentinel, and it sounded like there were so many opportunities to avert the disaster, the shooting in the first place, so many alarms that could have been raised, and so many logistical setbacks, including a time delay of 20 minutes on the video, the surveillance video, that people just could not respond. And when they did, they were already well behind the shooter. Those things must have really both fascinated and frustrated you as a reporter and a person.
It was astounding. It seemed like everything that could go wrong went wrong in that situation. The school resource officer didn't act, didn't take action. Nobody called a code red for a very long time. It didn't seem a real clear code red policy. The campus monitor, one of the campus monitors saw the shooter arrive on campus and get out of the Uber that brought him there, and he watched him walk onto campus with a large black duffel bag. And he thought in his head, oh, what's that kid's name? Yeah, I remember him. And he actually radioed one of his colleagues and said, oh, you know that one crazy boy? We call him Crazy Boy. What's that name? And they're like, Nicholas Cruz. And he's like, oh, he's on campus right now. And he described Nicholas as looking as though he were like on a mission. And they made some eye contact. And he said it seemed like Nicholas sped up. And that security monitor, Andrew Medina, he didn't approach the shooter. And he should have, because he didn't belong on campus. He wasn't a student anymore. He'd been a troubled student. He had caused problems. He had been expelled. And if Andrew Medina had just, he could have averted the whole thing.
Sounds like a lot of red flags.
Many, 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 many. Through the school system, through the mental health agencies and treatments that he had, there was so many things missed. The FBI bungled at a tip he had posted, I believe it was on YouTube, that I'm going to be the next school shooter. Nicholas Cruz, somebody called that in to the FBI just like very shortly before the shooting happened, a month or two. They didn't follow up.
The coverage was handled. You were there as well as many of your colleagues. And when the Pulitzer Prize was awarded to your newspaper, do you recall how you and your colleagues reacted?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I have an awesome little 1-minute video clip of it. Where we're all gathered and standing in front of a big screen on the wall. The Public Service Pulitzer is the first one they announced, so we didn't even hear who won anything else. Because once we erupted in emotional happiness and laughter and just like tears of joy, it was so meaningful. And I think we really, we felt like we truly earned it. And we all really felt like we did our best work all year long.
Really gelled as a team.
Oh, yeah. And I've been there 15 years. Most of the other reporters I worked most closely with on these stories, they've been there 20 years. So we all know how to work with each other, and we know each other's strengths and know how to team up.
What would you say is your strength? What do you add to the team, Tanya?
I'm often the one who I'll help report, but then I'll be the writer. So I'm a strong writer, and that's the part I really, really take pleasure in, trying to tell a good story. But I think I also, I try to come at all of my work with heart. I think that's different than a lot of other reporters.
We're in a time now where both people of color and journalists are dealing with a very contentious political climate. Reporters have been branded by this administration as enemies of the people. The administration has held back on condemning actions by white supremacists like we saw in Charlottesville. And this has all kind of just spiraled into, I think, a very toxic atmosphere for both groups. And I'm just curious, Tanya, if this has affected both you and your work.
Definitely. I think this is a very, very troubling, risky time. I think we should no longer take our First Amendment rights and our free press for granted. The fake news branding is damaging. Journalists are under siege, but we're not the enemy of the people. I'm not the enemy of the people. And it's ludicrous because we are the people and our voices are the people's voices. And I don't understand when in American history did being questioning and being inquisitive and practicing skepticism made you an enemy of the people.
For up and coming journalists of color, people from underrepresented communities, do you have any advice or insights as to how they can endure and prosper in this climate?
What really, really pushed me ahead, I think, is I was accepted into what's called the MetPro program at the LA Times. It's a minority editorial training program, and it is for reporters of color or non-traditional or maybe reporters who their first steps just it wasn't going right. And it's a incredible program, and they still do it, and I would really recommend looking into programs like that. It's a 9-month program. They put you up in housing. You do 6-week rotations covering a city, covering a police precinct, covering, you know, state desk investigations, maybe environment, maybe general assignment. Everyone had to go do a 6-week stint at a bureau. And it was really, really hardcore. It was competitive. It was like journalism boot camp. But the best thing about it was you got a LA Times byline as a staff writer.
That must have been very exciting for you to see your byline, your name there in print for the very first time.
Especially on the LA Times, yes. I mean, I got my first LA Times byline, I think it was only like 13 months after I'd graduated from journalism school. And it was like, I couldn't believe it. I was just like, this is like, things are working out and going down this charmed path.
What was the story, by the way?
My very first byline at the LA Times happened on Christmas Eve, and it was on the front page. I had been covering the city of Glendale, which has a very, very vibrant Armenian community. And there was a private school, a college, that had closed down, and they had an extensive library of Armenian books, and they were donating all of it to the city library. And so I explored the diaspora and learned about Armenia, and it was just like this cool story, you know, it was like this giving story of something precious and that meant something to these people. And it was a great story to tell. And I loved that it ran on Christmas Eve.
How was the reception to it? Do you remember?
I think it was good. I mean, I don't think I got too many wows, but I did land a column one at the LA Times. And that was like the golden ring that everyone, there's 10 Met Pros, and we all really wanted that. And I was the one that got one. And that story was amazing. It was this man, Fred Brito. And basically, he's a confidence man. But not for bad things or to rip people off. He would really, really super, super exaggerate his background and his experiences and his professional abilities. And he kept landing jobs for like major nonprofits. And like some like kidney foundation and then something else and something else. And then when he got caught, he had gotten hired at UCLA as like the director of like the donors program. And well, they caught on that guy doesn't know what he's doing and he got fired. And the Bruin, the daily paper at UCLA, wrote about it. And that's where we saw it and then pursued it from there. And it's not against the law to fake your endorsements, unless it's like a doctor or a lawyer, something where you have to have, you know, a license or a certificate. But basically just, you know, lying about, oh, I've got all this experience, I've got that experience. And then the deeper I dug, he had presented himself as a priest from the Norbertine sect or whatever they call it. And he got himself a position at a church in New Mexico, and he was there about half a year, and they loved him, and he was doing quinceañeras and baptisms, and you know, and then when he got found out, the community was like freaked, like, oh my God, like he baptized our baby, but is he really baptized anymore? And it's just like Fred had this, like, it just went deeper and deeper and deeper. And what I really learned with him, he was a real psychology lesson for me. The more I just like gently like asked and pried, more and more he'd let it out, but he wouldn't offer it. And so then I'd go back to him and say, what about this? And then he'd spill it and go, oh, yeah. You know, yeah, I did this. He listed a reference and the reference phone number. And Fred had a cell phone with that number. And he was the reference. So when they would call the reference, he'd get on and, you know, do his voice a little different, I guess, and give himself a raving review. And then he'd go get hired again at some good job. And so I landed a column one out of it. And that one was really, I got a lot of good feedback on it. Dateline ended up running it. And then a few months after I had left the LA Times, my program was up. I was now in South Florida working. And a reporter at the LA Times called, and they were asking for Fred's cell phone number because he had become like the head of the Red Cross disaster relief. And then became very clear he didn't know what he was doing. And then so it became another story. And then it was just like Red Cross. 2 months ago, we had Fred Brito on the front page.
That sounds like a lost chapter of Better Call Saul or something.
Really, really is. It was a fantastic story. I got an email within the last 3-4 months. Subject line said, a Pulitzer Prize. And it was from Fred Brito. He emailed me and was like, saying hello, and I want to tell you congratulations on the Pulitzer. And, you know, it was a short little message, and then it was just like, and you might be happy to know, it's been like, I've been like crime-free or trouble-free or for like 8 years or something. Like, you know, he had a clean slate the last 8 years. I emailed him back.
Your career has involved coverage of criminal courts, the state legislature, killer clowns, natural disasters. What's been your favorite beat or most compelling story to date?
I hate superlatives because it forces you into the one, so I could say among the favorites or more. I've written more stories, though, that are just so crazy and beyond, like you just couldn't make it up because that's how South Florida is. But the killer clown story is absolutely, it's mind-blowing. And last year, I got to do a podcast. I did my first podcast. I wrote it. I did some of the recording. And it came out really great. So that was an awesome new experience. But the killer clown of Wellington, I work a 2 to 10 p.m. shift. So I'm like the night cops reporter. And I think it was around 6 p.m., Palm Beach Sheriff's Office puts out a news release that after 26 years, they've made an arrest in the killer clown case. I had never heard of it. I was like, what? Killer clown case? Well, I looked in our archives, and we had covered it extensively at the time. So I had a fantastic archive to build stories off of and background and to work with. So right away, that night, as a daily, I was able to turn a really good story. Okay, no, I didn't say what the killer clown did. The killer clown...
Doesn't sound good.
No, a person dressed like a clown, carrying balloons and a little basket of flowers, pulled up to a house in Wellington, Florida, and knocked on the door, and a woman named Marlene Warren answered the door and said something like, oh, how nice. And the clown shot her in the face and killed her. Mm. Then went and got in its car that had no plates and drove away. And there was never an arrest. But police early on had their suspects. And it involved Marlene's husband, who owned a like budget rent-a-car or something. There was a young repo woman there who it was rumored or pretty well known. They were clearly having an affair. He was paying the rent for her apartment.
That's a little samey.
Yeah. Okay, so those two were the suspects immediately, but they never had real evidence. It was all super, super circumstantial. Go forward 26 years when they make the arrest. It is Sheila Keene. Sheila Keene was that repo girl way back when at Mike Warren's car lot. She was arrested in Abingdon, Virginia. She was married to Mike Warren.
Small world.
Crazy world. So I also immediately, like I think it was a Thursday, got assigned to go to Abingdon. Go turn a story for Sunday paper about who are they? Who are those people there? How are they perceived there? How do they come across? And so I, you know, start with neighbors. It was a wonderful, willing neighbor who loved and adored them and was good friends with them and did barbecues with them and such. And she gave me like a 2-hour interview and was telling me the good things about them. But along the way, she kind of slipped and she referred to Debbie. And I was like, what? Debbie? Who's Debbie? And she kind of like a look like, oh. And she's like, oh, we call Sheila Debbie. And I'm like, what? Her name's Debbie? You know her as Debbie Warren? Did you know her name was Sheila? No, they didn't know her name was ever Sheila. So basically what I figured out was she had moved to Virginia. She was married to the husband of the woman she killed. And she had a new name. She was Debbie Warren. No more Sheila Keene.
You can't make this up.
Nope, you cannot.
Well, I have just one last question here, and this is kind of a broad question, but I'd be curious to know your thoughts. Over the last 20, 30 years, we've seen the rise of the internet, the drop of ad revenue for papers, a number of newspapers being bought out by large corporate conglomerates, family papers in decline, the media landscape itself having been almost dramatically rewritten over the last 20, 30 years. So I'm just curious, you know, as an active journalist, Tanya, where do you see the field of journalism headed right now?
That's a good question. I don't know, but I think despite all the denigration the media is taking currently, it is kind of creating a generation or an era or a time when it's making a lot of people super interested in journalism. And I think the same thing happened with Watergate and All the President's Men. I think that movie, like, just everyone wanted to be a journalist after that. And I think right now a lot of people are feeling like that's a career worth pursuing.
We see an administration that is routinely bashing the New York Times and the Washington Post, many other papers that do not give him favorable coverage 24/7. And while I think there are some, like you said, who have that tag fake news and are using it against reporters, I can't help but wonder if there are some who see this happening and are intrigued and fascinated by journalism and what it can do. Make the powerful accountable and uneasy.
Absolutely. And I think that what attracts a lot of people to journalism, you're a journalist, you end up with, you get quite a lot of access. And for the most part, people feel compelled to return your calls and respond to you. So I think people are like, realize it's a powerful thing that you are responsible for. And you just, somewhere along the way, you start contemplating how sacred it is and that you really, really, how important it is to protect our free press, but also practice it as much as possible. And even just keep pushing when people are like, we were with the Parkland coverage early on, people are like, enough already, why don't you stop picking out the scab, the community, just let us heal, quit. But we kept finding out so much information that we felt was of the utmost importance for the public to know and learn from, and we kept going. And that's yeah, don't let people try to shut you down by like, oh, stop, it's not a story anymore, or no story here. Whenever someone says that, you know there's a story there. And I've never, ever, ever written a story to sell a newspaper. A lot of people like to use that as a, you know, a little dig at reporters.
Tanya, was there anything else that you wanted to mention or talk about while I had the recorder going?
I would just say, if you are in the vicinity and you have any interest in journalism, LCC has a program where I got started, and it's got a student newspaper that gives you hands-on experience. You got a fantastic journalism school right in your town. A lot of opportunity. And journalism is the only career I can think of where you can hit the ground so fast and so hard and so young. Journalism is very welcoming to youth.
Tanya Alanez, I appreciate your time. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.